Happy New Year. We're back. Yeah, it was like, you know, the 2 weeks of crazy. I'm Doug White, and it's an all new year of the Security Weekly News. This is episode 264 in the week of 1 January 2023. We've got office space. Rest assured, your insurance may not insure anything. Lockbit, Thrilla in Manila, PyTorch, non-binary DDR5, Jason Wood, and more on the Security Weekly News.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals, by security professionals.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
It's the show that keeps you up to date on the latest security news twice a week, your trusted source for accurate security information and expert analysis. It's time for Security Weekly News.
How is your business staying one step ahead of cyber criminals? Secure your email, applications, network, and data with Barracuda. Protect your business and go from zero to security in no time flat. Whether your team is working in one location or many, Barracuda has solutions that are easy to buy, deploy, and use. Learn how Barracuda can protect your business against ransomware, phishing, and other cyber attacks. Visit securityweekly.com/Barracuda. That's securityweekly.com/Barracuda. Barracuda, your journey secured. All right, welcome to the Security Weekly News. Let's see what we got here. So an Ohio Supreme Court, and it's not the U.S. Supreme Court, it's a state level Supreme Court, but an Ohio Supreme Court decision came out in the last days of last year, which was a bit of a blow and a reminder to, if you're holding cyber insurance, that you might want to review your policies. Basically, what they indicated was that a ransomware attack against a business should not be covered, by the cyber insurance because the attack did not physically or directly cause harm to the tangible components of the software program encrypted in the incident. Okay. I'm not sure that was one of those things that almost sounded to me like it's somebody who doesn't actually know what this stuff is. But anyway, the case happened after a medical billing and record keeping software company called EMOI. But anyway, back in 2019, they got ransomware. So, you know, like everybody else. But the attackers demanded 3 Bitcoin in ransom, which was worth $35,000 in 2019, which is about $50,000 today. The company paid the ransom. So they just bought the Bitcoin, paid the ransom, and then they contacted their insurer, which was Owners, and asked for the ransom and the recovery costs back. But the claims office, they said it rejected the claim in the same day. So, you know, it's insurance. When you call and say, hey, are you paying for this? I've been paying all these premiums. They go, no, you have to fight us over it. But anyways, the claims office rejected the claim immediately and said that EMOI's policy did not cover this sort of thing. So they sued and they won. Then the insurance company appealed and they won. And so the whole thing then went to the state Supreme Court. And so according to the court, their policy, so this is the EMOI policy that they had agreed to, their policy specifically states that the policy only covers direct and physical damage or loss to an asset. Which sounds like, why did you agree to this? Because, I guess I agree with the Supreme Court if that's what the policy says, because it doesn't sound, you know, now it's like basically insurance if your rack goes up in flames, but it's not going to cover you for ransomware, which is probably why they got the policy in the first place. So it's almost like a physical property loss policy rather than a cyber insurance policy, in my opinion. Well, the court went on and said that computer software cannot experience direct physical loss or physical damage because it has no physical existence. Yeah, okay. And then subsequently, since there was no physical damage, whatever that would be, the insurer did not have to pay. So it sounds like a really, really rotten cyber insurance policy because it's only going to cover things where malware or a hacking attack somehow causes physical and tangible damage to, I guess, your hardware. And maybe, because you can't apparently damage software. So it's kind of like those burial insurance policies that don't actually cover burial expenses. It's like you pay for them and they cover something really weird. So make one of your New Year's resolutions a full review of your cyber insurance policy language and maybe find a better insurer if you're, you know, if your policy, you know, is like an auto insurance policy that doesn't actually cover auto accidents, which occur in a motor vehicle. So, yeah, you might want to review that, right? Like right now. And then who says criminals have no heart? It's the holiday season. It's, we're after the holiday season. Now we're coming up at the awards season, but it's after the holiday season, but during the holiday season, criminals with a heart of gold. Lockbit ransomware gang, one of the most prolific and you know, virulent ransomware gangs out there, released a free decryptor for the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto. They had the hospital had a ransomware attack on the 18th of December that hit internal corporate phones and the website for this medical provider, and they didn't have to shut down, but they did say that this delayed labs being done, imaging results, and so forth, which caused long wait times for patients at this, and you know, and these are children, so that's like 10 times worse than if it was adults. But you know, if you've ever been to the hospital with your child, you know how much fun that is. But by the 29th of December, so notice how long this went. By the 29th of December, the hospital said they had restored 50% of their systems, which included the diagnostic and treatment system. So they were basically sort of back up and running. And it took 11 days. But anyway, Dominic Alvieri, who is a threat researcher, had noted this attack 2 days after it occurred, or after they announced that it occurred, and Lockbit issued an apology for the attack and released the decryptor for free. Bleeping Computer said that the decryptor is available for free if you need it too, and claims to be a Linux VMware ESXi decryptor. That claims to be thing made me kind of nervous. But Lockbit said that a partner, and remember, they're a ransomware as a service provider as well, so they sell their services, but they said a partner attacked the hospital and violated their rules and was now excluded from their programs. Uh-huh. And Lockbit went on and you know, they provide all kinds of stuff like this for their friends, you know, or their friends in the Bronx, as Tony Soprano might say. But they apparently have a lot of rules for a criminal organization. I was looking at this and it was like, wow, you guys have a lot of rules and probably an HR department or something. But the article talks about why they didn't offer the decryptor sooner. They talked about, even though, you know, like what they were asking, why did they not offer this, you know, quickly, because, but you know, they did offer it, but they do regularly attack hospitals and such, and they have all these different rules about when you can attack and what you can do and you know, and all this stuff. But anyway, it was a Christmas ransomware miracle. Tonight on Hallmark, a peppy young lad from the big city returns home to Hooterville to help with a family wombat farm, which is on the brink of bankruptcy when the local vet's office is ransomware and our hero is called in to save the day, only to realize that the love of their life is the head of the IT at the vet's office. Sparks fly. Yeah, check that one out. Well, since we're on the ransomware theme anyway for the new year, it did appear based on this report that ransomware attacks in 2022 impacted more than 200, and this is just reported ones, and it's in the government sector, more than 200 large organizations in the U.S. public sector, which includes government, education, healthcare, 105 counties, 44 universities and colleges, 45 school districts, and 24 healthcare providers were hit with ransomware in 2022. The report came from EMISoft, and there's a lot of other details in that report about, you know, the statistics and the cross cuts and all the different details about that. So if you're interested, it's worth taking a look. But my point is, since your insurance may be worthless because you didn't read it carefully and have four lawyers check it over to make sure the insurer wasn't trying to stick it to you, you might want to do a review of your ransomware policy. Sent, you know, A, review the ransomware policy. B, you might not have a sad story to tell about your business and your attackers may not care, so that you can't get a free decryptor. And C, well, you're probably a target. So even if you say, well, who would care about a chinchilla ranch in Ogallala, Nebraska? Well, they do. So as ransomware has expanded, they target people regardless of size. They don't care what industry you're in. They're going after everybody, but it was a massive year of hits in the government sector. So you really need to review your plans and test them out, like now, please, before it's too late and you're trying to get, you know, a sad story online. I'm sure you all heard about the travel delays last week, especially if you're flying on Southwest, since all of us probably at least know somebody who had their flights canceled, including me and my wife and my daughter and everybody else. And, you know, people are still trying to get home from some of these things. And if you were stuck in an airport and, you know, I don't know, somewhere you didn't want to be, you probably didn't have much fun. Maybe you're stuck in Las Vegas or somewhere, but you were probably stuck in uptown where there's no hotel room. So you got to spend, you know, the holidays in an airport. I personally stayed home after my flight was canceled, drank whiskey with my cats, though the cats did not drink any whiskey, drank whiskey with my cats, rewatched Babylon 5, and recorded networking lectures over the holiday. But everybody else got hosed. So I was at home and just, you know, got to watch it on everybody suffer. Well, you probably didn't hear about this one, though. So there was a New Year's Day hoo-ha, and unless you're traveling in Southeast Asia, in which case maybe you did hear it, a New Year's Day power outage at Ninoy Aquino, which is in Manila. If you've ever been through that airport, I've landed there several times en route to somewhere. And Ninoy Aquino in Manila, it's a big airport. They have a lot of traffic. They shut the airport down because of the power outage, and they also shut down the airspace. And so they have this massive airspace out over the Pacific with lots and lots of planes. The outage lasted 8 hours and pretty much grounded or diverted all the flights in the Philippines airspace at that point. The problem emerged with a power loss, which then rolled over to the backup, right? So that's what's supposed to happen. And they had two backups because they weren't fooling around. So they had two whole backup systems, and both backup systems failed. Yeah. So one of them was damaged. And when they tried to get around it, the techs tried to manually bypass the damaged one, and they accidentally dumped 380 volts into the 220 volt system, which fried all the terminals that receive satellite data and the other backup system. So does this smell like fried chicken in here? Yeah, if you've ever been in that server room, but you've probably had that experience somewhat. So test your systems before you need them. Please. I mean, people never do this. And then, you know, the power goes out and they try to turn the generator on and find out there's like pigeons living in the fuel tank or something. Really? All right. And I saw this headline and I had to read it. I saw this headline on this story and I was like, what? What? And the headline says non-binary DDR5 is coming. What the hell does that mean? Well, now, if you tell me you are non-binary, I can say cool. And I know what that means. But what does it mean in terms of computer memory? I mean, I kind of know something about hardware, and I've worked with lots of hardware, and I keep up with hardware, and I had not seen that particular term used in the context of RAM before, so I thought maybe we should take a look. So, I mean, regular memory sticks have been around a while, right? I mean, that's like one of the very first things I ever had to deal with in like, you know, desktop hardware were like computer memory sticks back there when you were trying to get the 64K of RAM or whatever. And as nearly as I can recall, all memory that we have currently in existence and for the near future is binary. You know, it's based on bits. It's not going to be, you know, quantum or anything like that. It's binary. And so the more I read of this, the weirder it kind of got. Apparently, the term that they used in this headline doesn't have anything to do with binary in the sense that bits are being used and, or any of that kind of stuff. And so we all know that memory is a power of two, right? So you typically are going to buy 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, 5, 12, 1,000, 24, you know, all those numbers. I mean, you know, these are numbers we're all familiar with. They've been around a long time. And every one of them is a base power of two. So like 2 to the 3rd or whatever. It's not like some combination of bits. And so the whole story is about how they're working on it so that memory can expand in more granular ways by going, instead of from 32 gigs of RAM to 64, they could go by smaller steps. So they could go from 32 to 48 gigs, which is, I don't understand how that's not binary. I mean, you can write the number 48 in binary, guys. I hate to tell you. You can write all these numbers in binary. You can write 49 gigs in binary. So I don't really understand what the non-binary part meant. But instead of having to go from 32 to 64, you could go to 48 or 24. Or you wouldn't want to go to 24. I guess you could step down. You go to 96 instead of 128. To me, it was kind of weird. But the claim, anyway, if you read the article and you go on, you sort of discard the weird terminology. The claim is that by making the memory more granular, it could reduce the cost of RAM and therefore drive down the overall cost of systems, which that actually might be a good thing. So, you know, if instead of you need more than 128, but you don't really need 256. So if you could go to 160 or something, that might be a lot cheaper. And of course, in larger numbers, so if you're going from 128 to 256 and you went to 160 instead, you're getting a bigger savings because 32 to 48 just doesn't really seem like a big deal. But I guess the idea was that this should somehow reduce the cost of RAM and overall cost of systems. I just don't understand why it was called non-binary RAM. You know, it's just not a straight up base power of 2. It's like, you know, 2 to the 3rd plus 2 to the 2nd or something. So I don't know. I thought that was really weird. But it is an interesting concept. I mean, you've never seen those sort of intermediate. They used to have them, but you don't really anymore see the intermediate stages of RAM. I always go for as much as I can possibly get because that means the system will last longer. Last week, the nightly builds of PyTorch were injected with malware after a supply chain attack. And PyTorch, if you're not aware, and I have actually used this, is a machine learning library that's used in all sorts of things, including computer vision, chatbots, natural language processing, and all kinds of different things. But the problem was a PyPy package called Torch Triton. And apparently, it's a dependency for PyTorch. So I probably installed it before, too, because you know how you sit down and you want to run something and you download a library, and then it says, oh, you need these other 7 libraries as well, and you install all those, and then it says, oh, yeah, those 7 each have 6 dependencies, and you end up installing like 600 things. You know that kind of experience. But the malware apparently executed when the Torch Triton package is imported. It did not happen automatically because the dependency was not automatically fulfilled. And I don't know if in PIP you can set it so that it automatically, you probably can, but I usually wouldn't do that because I kind of want to know what's being installed when I PIP something. But, you know, just installing all those dependencies is hard to keep up with. But the malware then uploads sensitive information from the machine where it's running and targets any files that are smaller, that are 99,999 bytes or smaller. And it uploads the first 1,000 files in the $ home directory, or that's a system variable, the $ home path, and it uploads all the files that are equal to or smaller than 99,990 bytes in the .ssh directory. So, wow. So if you install PyTorch on Linux via pip between the 25th of December and the 30th of December, according to them, you need to uninstall it now and uninstall Torch Triton separately and then reinstall the whole thing with the current version so that you can, and you may want to review what you may have lost. So I would do a full review of that if you had that on any kind of production system. CISA added 2 Jasper Reports flaws into the exploited vulnerability catalog last week. And these are really ancient. And that's why this was remarkable to me. Both of these flaws were from 2018, and this is CISA's known exploited vulnerabilities, meaning they're being actively exploited in the wild. This was a directory traversal in Jasper Reports library, and I remember this story from 2019, which can allow web server users to access data on the host system, so old type of hacking thing. This, of course, can include credentials that may be stored in that web server's directory tree. The flaw was patched in 2019, but as we all know, web servers are often not patched for long periods of time and just sort of sit there running. And, of course, that sets up these kind of scenarios. The vulnerabilities affect major vendors that use Jasper Reports library, which includes IBM products, Jasper Reports server, and others. So if you have anything with Jasper Reports in it, you desperately need to patch it. And federal agencies are being required to patch this before January 19th. Well, during the holidays every year, he puts on the eagerly awaited off-Broadway production of the All Furry Christmas Carol, where Scrooge, and this year he played Scrooge for 2 hours dressed as a capybara. He's a legend of the furry suit. It's Jason Wood.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. I hope everybody enjoyed the holiday season and last couple of weeks of 2022. This article really I found to be interesting because it just kind of highlights some of the evolution that goes on with threat actor groups and how they experiment and change over time. I found the article originally on SC Magazine's site and basically discusses a report that was released by Kaspersky on the Blue Noroff Group, which is reported to operate out of North Korea. Now, if you aren't familiar with the name Blue Noroff, you may know them by names like APT-38 or Stardust Chilima or Beagle Boys or Nickel Gladstone, to name a few. So there are a couple of things here that I guess, as I was looking at these articles, I thought was kind of interesting. The first was mostly on the social engineering side of things, and this was really what the SC Magazine article focused on, was Blue Noroff has been going out and really working at pretending to be venture capital companies based in Japan, the United States, and some other countries. And they've registered domain names that look pretty convincing as far as if somebody's not paying attention, that that appear to be associated with some of these companies. Like one of the companies they targeted or pretended to be was Bank of America, bankofamerica.nyc, which is an alternative top-level domain. Companies like Bank of America, ABF Capital, Beyond Next Ventures, some Japanese venture capital companies in particular, were being masqueraded as them. And so what gets more interesting, I mean, the domain names, okay, that's cool. They went after these companies. So what? What became kind of interesting is that the campaigns then using these domains were targeted to startup companies. So anybody who would be very interested in potentially, you know, what venture capital for their organization, they get an email saying, hey, we've got something for some kind of contract that needs to be handled. Click on this link to pull down the documents and so we can get this taken care of. Or job offers is also one of the things that they talked about that were occurring in these campaigns. So the victim gets the email. The domain looks relatively legit and nothing super obscure or really random looking. And it's ties back into the culture around the venture capital and startups and plays on that idea of, oh my gosh, I really need to act on this. Kaspersky did note that they were seeing hands-on activity. I think they said within like around eight initial activity and then some hands-on activity follow-up within 18 hours of the user clicking on the link. This is something they're actively going after. Now, the second and probably more interesting part was I found actually in the report by Kaspersky, and I've got the links to both in the show notes. They get into their findings around Blue Noroff's efforts to reduce warnings about executing or opening files that you've downloaded from the internet. And I'm sure everybody has seen these where you download some software you want to install, you go to click on it, and your OS warns you, hey, you sure you want to open this thing up? Yes, execute the Steam installer or something like that, right? And so we go ahead and do that. This is basically called the mark of the web, or it's kind of like a little scarlet letter that the operating system puts on these files as you download them and says, hey, when the first time we open this, we get asked to open this, prompt the user, make sure that they really want to do this. Well, obviously the threat actors want to avoid prompts, anything that's going to hint around the fact that something is malicious. And so that's really where Blue Noroff is spending their time doing some experimentation here in this report. They're looking at different delivery methods of getting the malicious files to the end system. And they're using things like ISO files, which we saw last year, VHD files, a virtual hard drive files, basically things that can open up native inside of Windows. You open it up, here is this document in here for a job offer or a contract or something like that. And so the victim executes that. And then that executes the other files that are sitting right next to it and actually is the payload. Typically some kind of downloader is what's sitting next to it, so they can you get that initial execution, pull down additional tooling for execution. And Kaspersky has some pretty good information here on the file names, and this is stuff that I see in intrusions all the time as far as patterns and how files are named and what they're doing there, the different types of files, things like that. So I found that to be pretty good information there. So they're really, and they're just testing this out. Let's send out campaigns send these out on campaigns, see how we get responses, see which is more effective. Are we getting better click-through rate on ISO files versus VHD files versus whatever else that they're using? One other aspect of the report that caught my attention was actually on the downloader in the malware. Now, I don't spend time doing malware reverse engineering, so this was something that's a little bit I only read about. Out of my normal day-to-day. But what happens is, somebody opens up the malicious document, it kicks off the downloader. The downloader actually looks at the system, sees what security software is running on it, and then decides, how do I want to execute the command to download other tools? Well, if I'm running Avast, I'm going to run this command. If it's Windows Defender, I'm going to run this other command. If it's some other endpoint software like, I don't know, Trend Micro or something like that, they'll run yet another command. And so it's just they're looking for ways to execute based on what they think the endpoint security software is not going to fire on or prevent at all. So, some instances they'll use the curl command, and other times they'll use run DLL32. Again, it just depends on what the endpoint software is. They actually had a pretty good diagram, kind of a flow diagram of showing what the decision tree is for the downloader and what is it going to do based on that. They also talked about some of the lullabins, living off the land binaries, which isn't necessarily binaries in all cases, because in this particular case, they talked about a script that comes with the Windows operating system called sync appv publishing server.vbs. And what this is used for as part of Windows is to execute PowerShell commands that were set up via as a scheduled task. And so this is kind of an intermediary script. Lo and behold, it can download files from the internet. And the actors have found this, and now they're using that. So I personally hadn't run into this script before. I've seen lots of different methods for downloading files. So this one was a little bit of a new one to me, and was just a reminder there's always another binary or script or something or other that came with your operating system that has the capability to download files. And these are things that are going to be typically looked at as legitimate by a lot of endpoint software. What I liked about this article overall, for folks who are not looking at intrusions all the time, aren't necessarily familiar with what an actual intrusion looks like, what commands are being run, what are the payloads looking like, again, file name patterns, things like that. There's a lot of good information here in this report and other reports that are out there. For us to learn from. And some of these commands may take you back a little bit as you're like, wow, what is this? This looks very confusing. What are they trying to do here? So it may take you a moment to look at it and kind of break down what's happening. But it's really important to know this type of stuff so you can recognize what's occurring inside of an intrusion. And then you can take that and start asking yourself some questions that you could use in your own security program, such as, what patterns do I see in file names? How do they chain commands together to execute inside of a single line in a script? You see that a lot. How do they stage data for exfiltration? See them, append them to different files and they'll pull that down. What can you do to detect that? What tools do you have and would it give you that kind of view? So you could look at building like queries to look for different types of events or commands being executed or files being created or different types of transmissions. And then how can you turn around and make it to where you can execute those queries rapidly so you can constantly be doing them inside of your environment? These are some things to ask yourself and see where, okay, this looks pretty good. Oh, this is a blind spot for us. How can I address that? What do I need to do to shore that up? Definitely the times that I have, gone out there and started really digging through an environment, looking to see the unusual things that are executing, it's amazing what you can find. And I think it exists in most networks. So I think this is just a useful, very useful piece of information here provided to us about how threat actors are acting and how they are evolving over time. Again, that experimentation of using different delivery mechanisms to get around Mark of the Web. So I would highly recommend anybody look at this that's on defense and spend some time thinking about, what could we do here? How would I pick this up? And what do I need to do to make sure I can pick this up? Definitely good read.
All right. Thank you, Jason. Happy New Year. Well, I don't know if you've ever seen the film Office Space. It's kind of old now, but it was a Mike Judge film that was made back in the 90s. And one of the main tenets of the film is this salami attack where they're shaving odd cents off of transactions and putting it in their bank account. So this was this whole sort of the MacGuffin of this film. And if you haven't seen Office Space, well, you should probably go see Office Space or, stream it or something. I mean, come on. It's kind of a hacker movie. So they always ask, what's your favorite hacker movie? I think somebody did say this once, and it is kind of a hacker movie in a way. But I ran one of those things a long time ago just to prove it could be done. It was a, security problem in the system at a bank where I worked and got a whole pile of money, but I didn't get to keep it. I just had to turn it back in, but I probably should have kept it and just skipped town and went, ha, ha, ha. But, that's not my style. But it was also a major plot component of Superman 3 with Richard Pryor as this nerdy villain coder guy. But anyway, a Seattle software engineer was charged for a similar theft and said that they were inspired in the police statement by the movie Office Space. They had taken about $300,000 and moved it into their personal account by shaving cents off of shipping fees at their employer, Zulily. I guess that's how you say that, which is an online retailer. There was even a document on the seized laptop called Office Space Project. The person's name was Arminildo Castro, and was apparently... this person had been assigned to the discrepancy investigation group for shipping fees. And when investigators figured this out and showed up at Castro's house, they found thousands of items piled up by the front door and in the driveway that had been ordered with the money. And Castro claimed it was all a mistake that was the result of a test, and he forgot to return many of the items, but there was a lot of evidence to the contrary. The police report explained the plot of Office Space even, which was kind of funny. But anyway, that's the news. Thanks, Jason, and I will see everyone on Friday. Happy New Year.